Thank you, worship team. Jane, you're a bit under the weather tonight. Thank you for toughing through it. You sound good as always. I'd like to invite you to turn to Acts chapter 20, which is where we are currently at in our study of the book of Acts. Acts chapter 20, there's a Bible under the seat in front of you or under your own seat if you don't have your own Bible. Once we get through Acts, I'm going to move to the NRSV that is the Pew Bible that most of you may be referring to. Yeah, and I think I'm going to do that just simply because I may be one of the last people using in a New International Version. Does anyone else have one? Just maybe a handful, a smattering. It's a good translation, nothing wrong with it, but I just think most of us are using the NRSV at this time. We made that change initially for the confirmands. The confirmands were using NIVs, and we don't have to really worry about that over the summer and as we get into Romans. Acts chapter 20, we're turning a corner in our study of Acts, because if you recall, the last 3 weeks, the church has just been a big troublemaker. Everywhere Paul goes, riots occur. He raises trouble and concerns. People get aggravated by him. And the church, so far in the book of Acts, everywhere it's gone, it's produced fruit, but there's always been a lot of trouble accompanying it. So that what's interesting as we move into chapter 20, we're going to have three accounts right in a row of the church being the church, without any trouble or turmoil. We're going to get three vignettes or windows into the early church's experience in life, which is going to help us understand what's going on in Acts. Many people read Acts and they think it's just the story of Paul setting up churches and moving on, when we've seen again and again he goes back to revisit, to encourage, to make sure the churches are doing well. But we rarely stop at a church and see how it's doing in the normal course of everyday events. Kind of what you and I are going through right now and every time we meet. It's rhythm, it's routine, it's just the normal stuff that we do. We don't get many pictures of that in the book of Acts, but for the next 3 weeks we're going to get that. A window into the early church life. It's going to involve travel from place to place, but once the travel's done, there's this beautiful picture of the church in action. So chapter 20, we're going to cover the first 12 verses. The first paragraph is all the travel, and this will be the harder part to follow. And then we move into the vignette or the window of the church. So are you ready for a lot of names and a lot of locations and details? Do your best to at least listen. I'll try to show you the path that Paul's taking after we read through this. When the uproar had ended, and that's the uproar that Demetrius caused last week with the silversmith and his business plunging because of Paul and the Christians. So when the uproar had ended, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. He traveled through that area, speaking many words of encouragement to the people, and finally arrived in Greece, where he stayed 3 months. Because the Jews made a plot against him just as he was about to sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. He was accompanied by, so that's most of the travel log, and now we're going to see who his traveling companions are. But before we go into all that list of names, I just want to give you an idea of what's happened in just those few sentences. Paul's in Ephesus, this is where all the trouble with Demetrius had occurred. After that occurs, he travels through Macedonia. He revisits a number of churches that he had already established on the second missionary journey, Philippi and other places. He comes down to Greece, where there's a church in Corinth, and Centria, and he spends 3 months there enjoying their company and encouraging them in the faith. It's during that 3 months that most people assume that he writes the book of Romans. They assume that he's 3 months there because it's winter when he arrives. Ships aren't going to sail for months. And he writes the book of Romans because at this point we know he wants to get back to Jerusalem in order to then come back and go all the way to Rome. We already know of his ambition to hit Rome. And so it's interesting to just look at a small section of Romans that will mean nothing to us when we get to Romans, but it's actually one of the reasons Paul's writing to the Romans. It's in the second to the last chapter, and he says, "But now that there is no more place for me to work in these regions, and since I've been longing for many years to visit you, I plan to do so when I go to Spain." And you might think, Spain? That's even more ambitious than Rome. But he did have his eyes on Spain. Rome wasn't the final place. It was his Washington, D.C., but then he planned to move even further west. I hope to see you while passing through and to have you assist me on my journey there, that's the church in Rome, after I've enjoyed your company for a while. Now, however, I am on my way to Jerusalem in the service of the Lord's people there. For Macedonia and Achaia were pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the Lord's people in Jerusalem. They were pleased to do it, and indeed they owe it to them. For if the Gentiles have shared in the Jews' spiritual blessings, they owe it to the Jews to share with them their material blessings. So you get a picture of what's occurred after he has spent time for the second time in Macedonia. He feels like his work there is accomplished. He successfully planted some churches. He's here in Corinth. He's wintered for a while. He writes all the way to Rome, which is way over here, in order to say, I am coming. And when I come, I hope to spend some time with you so that you can support me in my mission then to Spain. So that's where we stop there. But if you notice in our text, let's see. He stayed there 3 months. The Jews, verse 3, had made a plot against him. And just as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. You notice at the bottom of this slide, it says the return trip. Here was his plan. After he wintered in Corinth, his plan was to get on a ship and take the easy and fast route to Syria so that he could then go down to Jerusalem. That was his plan. He found out there was a plot. Whether it's a plot to deter him or a plot to kill him, it's a plot against him. He has enemies that are after him. They are expecting him to take the early train to Jerusalem. He decides, I'm going to put them off my track. And I'm going to take my time and go back through all these churches that I had planted, revisit them one last time, and then by the time we're done with this paragraph, he'll end up in Troas. So he's going to make the return trip on land, and you'll see this ends up being his final return trip. Obviously, it throws off the plot because they're not able to stop him, at least at that point. So that's where we are up to verse 3. Now here's the traveling companions. During all these travels, you have to imagine that Paul has a pack with him, a pack of disciples from all the various churches that he's established. You ready for some names that you never want to call your children and or your pets? Verse 4, he was accompanied by Sopater, son of Pyrrhus from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy also, and Tychicus and Trophimus from the province of Asia. These men went on ahead and waited for us at Troas, but we sailed from Philippi after the Feast of Unleavened Bread and 5 days later joined the others at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. You got seven names there. And I thought this might be the easiest way to understand those seven names. You're all mostly familiar. Really, this came to me, I think, wonderfully, because I thought, you know, we remember Jan, Brady, Mike, and all of that. You're never going to remember Secundus and all these names. Timothy's perhaps the one you'll remember, because Timothy is one that we're familiar with. But if you put these names in that same grid, it at least seems possible to make some sense of why we have this group of people traveling with Paul. When you realize that there are from different regions. Sopater's from Berea, Aristarchus from Thessalonica, Secundus as well, Trophimus, Tychicus, Timothy are from Asia, Gaius is from Derbe. You realize that these are all people from churches that Paul has planted. They are people that are representing from their churches, and they are going to accompany Paul back to Jerusalem. Many of them are probably Gentiles, and they, in accompanying Paul, are showing the fruit of his ministry everywhere he's gone. So Paul has this pack. It's not the Brady Bunch, it's Paul's pack that's come along with him. And there's one additional person, because you remember in the Brady Bunch, in the very last seconds of the opening montage, you always threw in Alice. And here we're throwing in an individual which you might not notice because he's not named, but in verse 6 we resume that first person plural language. Verse 6, but we sailed from Philippi, which many people suggest this may be Luke, or it could be the author's way to say you get in this story as well. This becomes so intense that we're actually caught up in the travel. I think it's better to see it as Luke. Many of these people we'll never hear from again. A few of them we will. Timothy is obviously one of the ones that we will definitely hear from again and again. A couple of letters will be written to him. Aristarchus, we read in the end of Colossians that he's a prisoner with Paul. So he ends up being jailed along with Paul for preaching the gospel. Believe it or not, Tychicus is the one that gets the most airplay after those. And he gets four verses in Paul's letters, Ephesians, Colossians, 2 Timothy, and Titus. He is called twice a dear brother and a faithful servant. And in 2 Timothy and Titus, Paul sends Tychicus out on his behalf to lead those churches. That's how important Tychicus is. He's a very, very trusted and faithful servant that Paul sends out to pastor and to lead these churches in different regions. So we have this incredible pack, and that's why this lesson's called Traveling Companions. But there is a reason why they're all together in a pack. We've already mentioned one of them, and that is when he finally arrives at Jerusalem, he's got this wonderful cavalry of people from all types of backgrounds that are there to represent Paul's success. But even more importantly, and you heard it in the reading from Romans, they have an offering. One of Paul's passions was to make sure that the Jerusalem church and the Gentile church remained bound together in faith, that there was a strong bond between them. And Paul was aware that Jerusalem church was struggling, they were in need, they were impoverished. So everywhere Paul went, and we read about it in some of his epistles, he took a collection from the Gentile churches who themselves were often impoverished, so that they could then take the collection and present it to the church at Jerusalem as a token of solidarity, as a way of saying, we owe you just as you have shared with us, and also as a way of showing that the gospel is united, Jew and Gentile. So it's very important that they have these traveling companions. The one other factor that comes into play when you're carrying that much money on Roman roads with bandits and all kinds of threats, it's good to have a lot of people around you to make sure that that money's protected. It's also good to have that many people to keep you responsible to make sure all the money's going to get there. It shows integrity and other such things. So that's our traveling companions. All this talk about moving back and forth, but finally they land in Troas, and that's where we're going to end our time tonight. They land in Troas, and that's where we get this little beautiful vignette of the church at Troas, with a bit of a funny thing that happens. Funny if you've got a morbid sense of humor. But maybe even funny if you don't, because someone's going to fall asleep at church and maybe die. It's hard to tell whether the text has this person die or they just looked like they were dead. We'll see it here in a moment. So here we go. It's all right. Doug's awake, so everything's good so far. Verse 7. On the first day of the week, we came together to break bread. Paul spoke to the people, and because he intended to leave the next day, kept on talking until midnight. There were many lamps in the upstairs room where we were meeting. Now you see the church at worship. That verse is so good at showing us in just a small space what we continue to do thousands of years later. The first day of the week. This is the first mention of the early church making it a custom not to meet on the Jewish Sabbath on a Saturday, but they're meeting on the Lord's Day, or the day that the Lord was resurrected, on the first day of the week. That means, contrary to our experience in our Western culture, that's a work day. That's equivalent to our Monday. And so people are working, and if you're going to go to church, you aren't going to be able to go early morning, because that's when you work. You get up and you go to work. You're going to have to go in the evening. And so the church is meeting in an evening. They don't have a building, so we'll find out later they're in someone's apartment, probably up on the third story. You'll notice that they meet on the first day of the week, and they gather together to break bread. So they come together, not just for communion. We've kind of scaled it down with our communion. We hand out the wafer or a little bit of pita bread at the second service, and then we dip it in the wine or the juice. All of that symbolic and beautiful. But the early church, most likely, every time it had its love feast or communion, breaking bread means really breaking bread. and in the midst of that meal together, a shared meal which shows solidarity, welcome, common life, all of those wonderful things in the ancient world, and it still does bear that idea still today, they would then end the meal with the Lord's Supper. And so they break bread, they meet on the first day of the week, and the preacher preaches far too long. So it's all the things we're used to. Paul speaks until midnight. So anytime you think I'm going long, or any pastor you know is going long, realize that he or she probably isn't keeping you there until the dead of night. But Paul's sermon is going on a lot. He is preaching, he is witnessing, he's perhaps sharing of his experiences. He's also encouraging him in their faith. He knows he only has so much time with them, and that more than likely this is the last time he'll see them. So he stays with them until late in the evening. Church gets a little bit long. There are lamps lit. It's late at night. And poor Eutychus. Eutychus is a slave's name. It's more than likely that Eutychus was a slave. The common slave name means lucky. And an owner would give a slave the name, and he would probably give the name Lucky to the slave, because if you're going to employ slaves, you want them to bring you luck and prosperity and blessing. So Eutychus, who's named Lucky, who's probably worked all day long, is absolutely tired. So verse 9, seated in a window was a young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on. I've had that experience, have you? I mean, it doesn't matter who the speaker is. You're just exhausted, and all of a sudden you're hearing wah, 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 wah. It's just a dull tone that's allowing you. And then you add the late night, you add the smoke and the light, and he's sinking into a deep sleep, which is just fine if he wasn't sitting by the window. But apparently this poor guy, Lucky of all things, is sitting on the window. He falls asleep. He fell to the ground from the third story and was picked up dead. Now that will throw a wrench into a church service. I mean, that's, if anything's going to take away from the worshipful mood and make people really think, you know, this is no fun anymore, this is not encouraging anymore, this would do it. So Paul goes down. They're meeting in an upper room of all places on the third story. Verse 10, Paul went down, threw himself on the young man, much like Elijah does in the prophetic stories, puts his arms around him and says, "Don't be alarmed. He's alive." Now the NRSV is a little bit better. There's life in him. Which is why Luke seems to be ambiguous about whether he fell and died and Paul raises him, which is well within what we've seen Paul do in the Gospels and how they work. But it could very well be that Paul says, hey, you know, he's not dead yet. He's still alive. It's just a flesh wound. Whatever Paul does, he then obviously lifts the boy up, and notice, without any fanfare, verse 11, worship continues. Then he went upstairs again and broke bread and ate, as if none of this had ever occurred. After talking until daylight, he left. The people took the young man home alive and were greatly comforted. It's just amazing how Luke tells this story of Eutychus, and he drops, and he either dies and is raised, or he is stunned and he's still alive. No matter how it is, it's as if that's irrelevant to the story Luke wants to tell. Because as soon as Paul has done his deed, he just gets right back up. They go back to communion. They're sharing a meal together. Paul continues preaching. He doesn't stop preaching. He broke bread after talking until daylight. Did you see that? Daylight. So now we're way past midnight. He left, and obviously they take the young man home alive, which means Eutychus didn't dare fall asleep again. I mean, he was up for the night, whether it was from a concussion or something. He's up for the night. One of the interesting things about this story is it really does mimic church life, because here we are, we gather on certain days of the week. On the Lord's Day, here we are gathering with a rhythm and routine on Wednesdays. We have a certain routine. We gather together to share faith, to be encouraged together. And yet, in the midst of our gatherings at times, all of a sudden, without any preparation, tragedy strikes. We saw it with Judy Johnson 2 weeks ago. We saw it just this week with Janice. who's passed away, and I hope you have read that. I hope people have seen that, because that was a shock to me when I found it out this very morning. I went to go visit her, and she wasn't there because she had passed away. And these things just shock you. You reel and recoil for a while, or other things happen, and we're allowed to share this now. Jeremy Walter, who has testicular cancer, and they're treating it right now. They're in the middle of immediately treating it. Here we are, we go through, we meet together, we gather, we encourage, and these tragedies just pop right up in the midst of our shared life together. One of the authors that I consult says this about how that occurrence hits us. Tragedy tends to come upon us like that. We're at church, things are going along as usual, then someone slumps forward or a cry goes up, there is a shock, tragedy engulfs the flow of the ordinary. A once vibrant young disciple is dead, the word is like a gavel coming down, a door banging shut, the end dead. We're suddenly rendered speechless and immobilized. It just hits us, and this is life in the church. People we love, people we care for, things happen, and all of a sudden we don't quite know what to do. Now, what's interesting about this particular story is Luke doesn't want to set our heights, expectations so high that we assume anytime tragedy strikes, there's an immediate answer. Anytime tragedy hits, miracles are always going to happen. Because he has Paul, without fanfare, go down and say, hey, he's still alive, or raise him. But either way, Paul doesn't make a big deal of it. It's just business as usual, and he goes right back to why they're there. They are there not to be astounded by whatever just occurred with Eutychus. They are there to break bread together, to encourage one another in the faith, to make sure the word goes forward in power, to be the church in that community. Jerry Wall writes this, Luke doesn't want the reader to dwell on the miracle, and so Paul resumes the ministry of the word without pause. The hallmark of Christian community is not the miraculous, but the message of the risen Jesus. In a religious culture that's drawn toward the spectacular, the community of believers must be ever diligent to congregate around the gospel for instruction. I will never forget 9/11. 9/11, I was working at my first church, my Baptist church. I was going to pump gas in my car. I heard of some strange things happening as I was on my way to church. I got to church, everyone's watching TV, we're all enamored, we're all slowly realizing what's occurring. And we got through that day kind of watching the broadcast, just like all of us probably remember that day and that moment. And one of the things that some of the people, because it was a staff of 39, you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And the lead pastor who I worked for and learned so much from for 10 years said, what are we going to do? We're going to preach the word. I mean, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to stop? We're going to, just panic? Are we going to do nothing? We're going to do what we're called to do. We're going to make sure worship occurs. We're going to pray. We're going to preach the word. We're going to try to bring hope and light into the situation. He had it in his mind that whatever occurred, it wasn't going to veer him from the calling he had to build up the church and to strengthen it, and to help it move forward, and to make sure the ministry of word and spirit and breaking of bread and the regular gathering together of people continued to occur. And that seems to be what Paul's modus operandi is here. And it seems to be Luke's underlying message that something miraculous has happened. And if this were a news story in our day and age, you know what would get the most press? Eutychus, he was raised from the dead. I mean, that'd be the big news story. But the way Luke wants to tell it, that's kind of like a sideline issue in the church's life. They deal with it, then they get back to what really is the news story, the good news story of sharing the gospel and breaking bread together and being the community of faith in that location. So that's our story. I want to make three reflections as usual that come from the text that has to do with Paul's traveling, his companions, and this portrait of the early church. I was so tempted to make one of the points of reflection, if you fall asleep in church, you die. That would be so unfair. That would be so unfair, because it's not what the text says. I actually think we're supposed to have a bit of compassion. And I wrote in our Facebook thing that, you know, come to church, and if you fall asleep and you're tired, you know, we're just glad you're here. I mean, that's really the truth. If I had in my singles group for years a guy who came, and every Wednesday we had our Through the Bible studies on Wednesday night, he'd come, and within 2 minutes his head was back, and And it was very obvious. I mean, the poor guy. And I just thought, at least he gets here. I mean, it's not like he's not trying to be present and to participate. He either has some sleep dysfunction, or I bore him to tears, or, you know, he's just doing his best. Or he'd worked hard, or who knows what. But I will never forget that. And I just kind of always thought, I'm glad he at least made an attempt. And if nothing else, we know he's still alive and around. So I would never do that, fall asleep and you die. I actually have much compassion for Eutychus. Instead, I want to focus on what I think Luke wants us to focus on. It's not so much Eutychus, but it's what's going on in our story. And this may be the most obscure, but I hope to make it very clear. What Luke is setting us up for is the Passion of Jesus, part 2. Because everything Paul is going through in many ways reflects what Jesus had previously gone through. Which makes sense when you realize that Jesus had said to Paul, I will show you how much you must suffer for my sake. You know, he told Paul right from the beginning, you're going to preach before kings and you're going to have this great influence, but I'm also going to show you how much you must suffer for my kingdom's sake. If you don't remember it, it's in Acts 9. So Paul's well aware of that, and right from the beginning we're given this sense that Paul is not going to suffer because he's been bad. He's going to suffer because he's going to so follow the way of Jesus that many of the same things that arise related to Jesus and his goodness and the opposition to it are going to occur with Paul. For example, we've seen this for a few weeks already. Paul has resolutely set his face to Jerusalem, which is what Jesus does. That's why the Passion of the Christ occurs. He is bound and determined to move from Galilee and to reveal himself at Jerusalem, knowing what that might bring. As Paul makes his way to Jerusalem, the Jews hatch a plot to get rid of him. In the same way as Jesus is setting his face to go to Jerusalem, the Jewish people, particularly the leaders, the religious leaders who see him as a threat, hatch a plot to make sure that Jesus is undone. Jesus, as he moves toward Jerusalem, is surrounded by his companions, his 12 disciples. Paul, right here, is surrounded by his companions. His companions are the fruit of his ministry, just as the disciples are the fruit of Jesus' ministry, making their way into Jerusalem. Jesus comes to Jerusalem to do good, but is misunderstood. Paul's coming to Jerusalem to do good as well with the offering. And then finally, to just cap it all off, Jesus, before he enters Jerusalem, is in the upper room. And some amazing things happen up there. Paul's in his own upper room here. He's on the third story in the upper room, sharing the last night with these disciples in Troas and preparing them for what's to come, and they're up all night. So one of the amazing things is to see how Luke is setting Paul up to really follow almost identically in the footsteps of Jesus with one big caveat. When he finally makes it to Jerusalem, like Jesus, he'll be arrested. Like Jesus, he'll be put on trial. But unlike Jesus, he'll be sent to Rome in order to continue the trial. And he'll stand before kings and politicians and people in power and be able to say things and do things that Jesus did not have the opportunity to do. So it gets very interesting to see how Paul follows in that same path, also is arrested, also faces trial. And in fact, our last picture of Paul in the book of Romans leaves us with a cliffhanger. Paul's in prison awaiting a trial. We don't know whether he'll be beheaded. We don't know whether he'll be released. But he's just waiting there in prison, and that's how Luke leaves us. And so Paul is following in the way of Christ. And he is suffering, not because God likes to watch people suffer, but he's suffering because of the goodness of his testimony and his faithfulness to it. And this is how the powers of the world often react to such unassailed truth and beauty and goodness. And so we're seeing the passion of Paul. It might be obscure, but I hope you maybe see it a little bit more clearly as Luke develops this. This is, after all, Luke part 2. So he is retelling or continuing to tell a story that he's already told, and he's showing us the things that are similar. The second thing to reflect on is it's a beautiful picture of church at worship in verse 7, which we already elaborated on. It would be a shame to let the humorous incidents about Eutychus take away from what we're learning about the church in this account, that they gather on the first day. They gather sacrificially. They have to gather at night because they're working all day. They gather to break bread. They gather to encourage one another in the ministry of word and table. And they do it weekly. It's a rhythm. It's a routine. On the first day of the week, that's when they gather. The church that is scattered reforms, and they receive nourishment together and encouragement together. Which leads to my third and final reflection, and that is how important Luke wants us to see life together is. He is showing us a picture of the church in one location and its habits and its practices. And one of the things that we often lose sight of because we live it, particularly this group on Wednesday night, because you're the people that do the, you know, extra be above and beyond the Sunday rhythm. You have this other rhythm that also hopefully encourages you and inspires you. There is this commonness to it. It's just what we do. But you begin to see how precious this gathering is if it weren't there. And that's why that rhythm is so important. Will Willimon, who's a United Methodist pastor, I love his thoughts on church. He was a bishop of the United Methodist Church for a while, but before that he was a pastor for 20 or 30 years. And he writes this about the church. The things which happen when the church gather together to break bread simply do not happen for the church anywhere else. While we are busy praising God and exploring the ways of God in our worship, something happens to us. The ministry of encouragement. One of the things that I am convinced of, if you take off your church glasses for just a bit and you just look at the news broadcast and the radio broadcast and the TV advertisements and the social media, for the most part you'll realize that the world isn't generally naturally encouraging us to walk in faith and to walk by hope and to live in love. The messages we're getting are almost the opposite. Be dissatisfied, be outraged, you know, be cynical, be disappointed. And on we go with what we are given, which is meant to, I guess, inform us. But in many ways, it doesn't inspire or encourage us. But one of the things that church is about, and church in its best form ought to be, is a place where you know you have traveling companions. You have people that are sharing a common journey, a common faith, that have a common mission, that are looking out for one another, that have a common table, that show solidarity with one another, that are able to say, perhaps in ways that many other organizations and institutions can't, trust God, walk in the way of Jesus, walk in the way of love. It's all worth it. It all matters. None of it's in vain. It is of the most tremendous value. And that continual rhythm of feed on Christ, know you're loved, disperse, scatter, get spent, get beat up a little bit, perhaps come back, hopefully in a good church environment, be encouraged. You know, maybe sometimes be challenged, but the challenge is just to inspire us to even greater heights. Be encouraged, be challenged, move forward. It's all worth it. One last quote and I'm done, because this is so good by Willimon. The Church of Acts is not always on the move. And I said this at the beginning of the message. Many people have the idea that the book of Acts is really just Paul and others going and evangelizing and moving on. And so you never get really a picture of the church in its action in its home. Church as most would experience it in the ancient world. Not these apostles who were going about everywhere, but the common man and woman. And so the Church of Acts is not always on the move appealing to unbelievers. The church also gathers for worship and fellowship. Without the sustenance received at its Sunday gatherings, the church might lose itself in mere busyness, might forget who it is and whose it is. It might lose heart amidst the myriad of demands and assaults upon it by the surrounding world. You know, I'm totally sold on church, or I wouldn't do what I do. I know that there are bad expressions of church. I know that sometimes, uninformed and ignorant, we can be part of that. I'm well aware that everything good can be twisted, perverted, corrupted, and not live up to its full potential. But at the end of the day, the reason why I'm sold on church is I really do believe if you were to remove all the churches, we wouldn't make it on our own by ourselves. We need one another. We need a community. We need to be able to be encouraged together. We need a community that says, this is the way, stick to it. Don't lose hope. Don't abandon the faith, and that keeps admonishing us that the gospel is true. It's life, it's light, it's joy. It is something that's worthy of your greatest pursuit. That without that, we might tag along for a while in groups of, you know, handfuls, but when those handfuls began to be just one or two, and then one just trying to survive alone, I think that this thing would be too big for any of us. So that for good or for ill, the church in its best form is meant to really pass on the faith, keep the body encouraged, make sure that we're nourished and fed, make sure that whatever we do, we don't abandon the gathering and the worship and the table and the hospitality and the proclaiming of the gospel, because there's so many voices out there right now saying there's so many other good things we could be doing, and of course there are, but we can never let the good things outweigh the first things, what we have to be doing, because if we don't, no one else will. And what the church is doing is that beautiful word, fellowship. They're in fellowship. They're in koinonia. They are gathering together in order to be what all of us need, to be traveling companions. If Paul needed traveling companions, and if Jesus needed traveling companions, then I would assume that we do as well. Whether we're out on a mission like Jesus and Paul are, or whether we are one of those home bases for a mission like we experience, that we all need traveling companions in order to be encouraged to go on in faith. I think that's one of the lessons this story raises for us. Even in the midst of the morbid humor and the sad tragedy of Eutychus, no matter what occurs, resurrection allows us to keep moving forward. There always is hope. Would you pray with me?